Yes, sir.
One of the difficulties that creationists have is feeling like you're a minority in the scientific community. And so what has actually resulted from this is a combination of trying to combine both creation and evolution. We realize that evolution has taken over the scientific world, even though evolution is certainly not needed in relationship to doing good science. And so this has actually become known as a view called theistic evolution. That's the traditional term for it. There are other terms for it, but this is the one that has really stuck. Theistic because these are people who believe in God, theos, and evolution because they're seeking to also follow the findings of the scientific community. And once again, they're trying to do the same thing in terms of antiquity, the pagans of long ago, answering the question, how did the universe get here? But they didn't ask the question about evolution, because you don't really find any atheists in the time of the ancient Near East. But now we talk about evolution, and especially for those of us who are believers, if we accept the idea of evolution, we have to fit it in with Genesis. And so it raises a question, well, what does Genesis say? What does it actually say? Have we been actually reading it correctly? We understand that Genesis is very different from Enuma Elish, from the Sumerian myths. We understand that it's different from all of these other ones. We see that distinction, but we ask ourselves, what about today? What about all of the scientific achievements? This comes especially to the fore with a recent book, 2006, by Francis Collins. This book is called The Language of God, subtitle, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. So do you see where this is going? He's saying that the DNA is an evidence for God, but Dr. Collins also is a believer in the Lord Jesus. So he's a Christian, and he actually seeks to merge theism and evolution together in one of the more compelling supports of theistic evolution. And some of his language here, well, the language of the book is actually quite simple. You don't have to be a scientist to read this book. I found it quite easy to understand. He uses an inductive approach. By that, I mean he establishes his credibility as a scientist. I mean, after all, he's the head of the USA DNA project that unlocked the human genome, that helped us to finally understand the whole concept of DNA that we've known about for some decades, but no one's ever actually been able to figure it out. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. But he uses an inductive approach because he establishes his credibility and he talks about things relating to evolution and the DNA and all that, and he doesn't really let on until you get to the end of the book that he's actually a Christian. He has an apologetic stance. As you can see, a scientist presents evidence for belief. He's trying to be a defender of the Bible, trying to be a defender of God, specifically Jesus, to the scientific community. And I certainly don't doubt his heart or his intent in that at all. He's very much indebted to C.S. Lewis, who was another modern-day theistic evolutionist. One of my concerns with the book, and perhaps he would not think of it as being a critique, is that he has little interaction with Scripture. I think he feels that if he deals with things relating to the Bible, then he's going to put off his readers. And his goal is to have people actually read the book. And so he doesn't, he kind of leaves open this whole issue of like Adam and Eve, or at least it a bit ambiguous. Now, Francis Collins is one of the world's leading scientists, and he was appointed by the president to be the director of the Human Genome Project that studied the DNA. He started off in his scientific career as an atheist, but God's intervention in his life led him actually to Christ. And he doesn't actually share until page 225 of his book that he surrendered to Jesus Christ. So you have to read 224 pages before you actually get there, unless someone's clued you in that, you know, that's what he's going to say later on at the end of the book. The reviews of the book are really quite good. Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House in the United States, says, Francis Collins has written an extraordinary personal testimony about the compatibility of God and science. You see how the language is used? God and science. As if God and science are having some kind of argument, you know? His explanation of DNA as God's instruction book is persuasive. His explanation of his personal faith is compelling reading. That's quite a high, you know, adulation there. Kind of reminds me of these two men who comes at the house of the
Jehovah's Witness.
You kind of think they're Jehovah's Witness, but the evangelists give the homeowner a blank pamphlet, and they say, "Well, we're atheists." That's really not true in the sense that atheists don't present nothing. That's a double negative.
Yeah.
But it is true that that atheists are becoming more commonplace. We'll call them the word none. You know, what is your religion? Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, none. You've seen that, right? So the rise of the nuns, this is not N-U-N-S. It's not like more people turning to Catholicism. The rise of the nuns is that growing part of our population that are not affiliating with any kind of faith at all. Well, unless you call atheism a faith, which I actually do. It's a faith and no God at all. And probably Richard Dawkins is the poster child, you might say, today for atheism. This is what he says. Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Faith, being belief that isn't based on evidence, is the principal vice of any religion. So he thinks you ought to have faith without religion. Frankly, I guess you could say that's what he has. See, he has faith in his belief that there is no God. That is his faith. He's on the far left. On the far right would be someone like Henry Morris, who's now with the Lord, but would teach, or who did teach, creationism, and believes that what Dawkins taught is very much a lie. In fact, this is what Henry Morris says. Evolution's lie permeates and dominates modern thought in every field, and it's basically responsible for disintegrations that have been accelerating everywhere. When science and the Bible differ, science has obviously misinterpreted the data. So you have these huge divergence of views here, and Dr. Collins seeks to fit in the middle. He has established an organization called BioLogos. To see even the name itself, he's saying, I want to put life or biology or science together with logos, with the word. And this has become a very, very popular organization in the last decade or so. And some churches, like the Episcopal Church, have adopted theistic evolution as their standard belief. In 2006, the Episcopal Church passed a resolution supporting the teaching of evolution in schools. The resolution titled Affirm Creation and Evolution, that's what the title was, declared that evolution is entirely compatible with an authentic and living Christian faith. It also encourages state legislatures and boards of education to establish standards for belief for science education based on the best available scientific knowledge that's accepted by a consensus of the scientific community. And also occurring in the convention was the election of new presiding Bishop Catherine Jeffords Schori, who, as well as being the first woman elected to the position, is a former oceanographer with a strong evolutionary background. And this is what she said. Evolution most definitely should be taught in school. It's a well-tested premise and the best model that fits the data available. Creationism can't make that claim. I believe in the creeds. They say God created the world, but they don't say how. So you see how the argument goes? And when you have the head of the Episcopal Church saying theistic evolution is what the entire Anglican or Episcopal Church ought to hold, it's a pretty big step. Now, Francis Collins presents basically four different options. He says you could be an atheist and an agnostic, and that's when science trumps faith. So science is supreme, there's no faith. Creationism is when faith trumps science. His view of creationism is that you don't even care at all, you don't look at science. Because faith is
faith.
It's paramount, you know? Intelligent design is a third option in terms of the origins. And he calls it when science needs divine help. Intelligent design is basically many theists who try not to say that we can tell a lot about God by the world, but they are acknowledging that the world has design. So they separate themselves from the Darwinists in this regard. And then he puts his own organization as another option. Biologos, where he says faith and science are in harmony. Of course, you would expect that he would see it that way, and that's really where his conviction is on that. In fact, he says no serious biologist today doubts the theory of evolution to explain the marvelous complexity and diversity of life. Quite a statement. He was appointed by Bill Clinton, and when, I don't know if he said this in the presence of President Clinton at that time, but yeah, so those are the various options. Yes?
In this case, forget about macro evolution.
We're talking about macro evolution. I don't know anyone who doesn't believe in microevolution. By microevolution, we're talking about having different types of dogs that come from a common ancestor, different types of horses, etc. Everyone, to say that there are, to say that there's no differences is to deny that there are differences between us as we look around the room. Do you think we all look the same? I mean, this room is filled with people. You're all part of one race, but there's certainly differences between us. So how is he a theistic evolutionist? Now, he sees no contradiction between theism and evolution. I would normally make these contradictory. I would say, well, in theism, we believe in miracles. But in evolution, they would say, they believe in the Big Bang. Those who believe in the Big Bang would say, no, they don't believe in miracles. unless you call it Big Bang, the most amazing miracle that ever took place, you know. Those who believe in God would say God cares, but evolutionists would say, no, we've got this Big Bang and atoms. Everything's just composed of atoms without any sense of God designing anything, and there's no sense of God's care. And in we believe in creation, whereas in evolution they would say the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. They say the universe is up to what, 13.8 billion, I guess, right now. And then in theism we believe in moral law, but in evolution basically you've got just, there's no moral law. You, all you have is matter that came about, and the matter cooled into planets. In the minds of Dr. Collins, he believes you can put everything on the left with everything on the right. And it's definitely good for us to consider that. He says, for example, page 64, if everything in the universe is flying apart, reversing the arrow of time would predict that at some point all these galaxies were together in one incredibly massive entity. The universe began at a single moment 14 billion years ago. And he would say that, for example, Big Bang is supported with microwave signals throughout the galaxy. You've got microwave, the constant ratio of hydrogen, deuterium and helium throughout the universe. He thinks these are scientific supports for Big Bang, but he's also not willing to give up his faith in God. He's gone from atheism to faith in God. And so we've got all this actually quite in a quite a few views, even for those who are believers. Now, for example, we've got the two-phase view with a gap between what some believe to be original creation, Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, or maybe even Genesis 1. Another gap view would be putting the gap right here between verse 1 and then verses 2 and 3. So that what we've got in Genesis, in both of these, we see basically Genesis 1, or at least in the two phase, we see chapter 1 of Genesis as phase 1, chapter 2 being phase 2, with the creation of Adam and Eve. Prior creation view puts a gap between, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, but it believes that the earth got corrupted, or chaos ensued, and therefore there was chaos and God brought order to the chaos. So you actually have a recreation in the Genesis 1 account. Others who are just not wanting to deal with those sort of details say that these 7 days are really symbolic, and they have only a literary approach. The framework hypothesis would fit under this one. They say Genesis 1 is only giving a framework in terms of how the world came to be. And I've talked to some who believe this, and they say it just gives us a literary framework, but it doesn't tell us how the world came into being. And when I talk to people like that, I ask them, if it said how, what would you expect it to say? How different would it be than from Genesis 1? Because it seems like Genesis 1 screams at me about every verse, every phrase. This is how God did it. He did it by his spoken word, etc. The day-age one would be similar, that sees the days as an indefinite era. And there's where they try to fit in the supposed millions of years, saying that some days are thousands or millions of years long. And then, of course, there's the 24-hour day view that sees the days in the normal way that we would normally interpret days. And we will watch a video on that in the next hour, so I'm not going to get into the details of looking at that on the 24-hour view. So those of you who are following along, I'm just going to skip over the next several slides to jump in to say, I think there are problems with theistic evolution. This is page 70N in your notes, or if you're looking at the file on creation that I emailed you all, it would be in that one as well. I think there's some problems with theistic evolution, both scientific problems and theological problems. And some of these are critiqued by Creation Research Institute, that is formerly in San Diego now, I believe it's in Texas, and Answers in Genesis. So I would encourage you to go to those organizations for greater details on these sort of things. One of them is that you've got a very different way of looking at how origins came about when you look at the Big Bang. That said 14.8 or 13.8 or 15, it's kind of changing quite a bit, that there was this Big Bang, and then within 5 billion years after that, they were forming globs that turned into various galaxies, so that our sun came into being 5 billion years ago, or the Earth came into being 5 billion years ago, and it cooled, so that by 3.8 billion years, then we end up having water on our planet. Somehow, in their thinking, you got fire turning to water. All right? I'm not making fun of that. I'm just saying that is an observation of how they think it happened. And yet, what we find in Genesis 1 is we find that water covered the whole earth. So you're actually started with water. And then the water is separated from the land, and then the stars end up coming actually on day 4. So it's not like everything comes from stars and cools down. You've got the earth created first, and the stars created later. So I believe what we have here are, these are incompatible explanations. I think you have to make a choice whether you're going to follow the Big Bang or whether you're going to follow the Bible. So here's our BB or B, Big Bang or Bible. Big Bang says elements beyond hydrogen and helium formed after millions of years, whereas the Bible says all these elements formed together. The Big Bang says Earth formed long after the stars, over 10 billion years later. Yeah, about 10 billion years later. Whereas the Bible says the earth was formed before the stars. The Big Bang says that plants evolved after the sun. But the Bible has the plants formed before the sun. Some people think that's a big problem with the Bible. They say, how can you have plants on day 3, but the sun on day 4. And I say, do your plants live one day without light? If you turn the lights off, do all your plants die? But actually, you have light, actually, on these first 3 days anyway, that God creates from a source he doesn't say. The source is himself. Big Bang says birds evolve from reptiles. So they're seeking to say that these reptiles came, the legs grew wings, all right, and feathers. And there's a whole, whereas the Bible would say that birds were created before reptiles. Not very long before, like a day before. And you've got reptiles and mammals actually coming at the same time. Big Bang says the sun was formed before the earth, whereas it's the other way around with Genesis 1. Big Bang says the sun formed from the older stars, whereas in Genesis 1, we find the sun, the moon, and the stars all formed on day 4 of creation. So it's pretty difficult, I would say impossible, to reconcile the two, and this is one of the reasons I'm not a theistic evolutionist. In fact, many astronomers today are beginning to doubt the Big Bang. This theory has been around for, 40 or 50, 60 years. Werner Gitt is one who shares this. He says, if the universe came from a Big Bang, then matter should be evenly distributed. However, the universe contains an extremely uneven distribution of mass. And this means that matter is concentrated into zones and planes around relatively empty regions. Two astronomers, Geller and Hutra, embarked on a measuring program expecting to find evidence to support the Big Bang model. But by compiling large star maps, they hoped to demonstrate that matter is uniformly distributed throughout the cosmos when a large enough scale is considered. The more progress they made with their cartographic overview of space, the clearer it became. The distant galaxies are clustered in like cosmic continents beyond nearly empty reaches of space. The Big Bang model was strongly shaken by this discovery. And that's what I would say to Dr. Collins. You say that he's not an astronomer, but he says that the even distribution of everything throughout the world would be a support of the Big Bang model. And I'd say, what is so evenly distributed? Even our planets in our own solar system are not evenly distributed. And the solar systems and the galaxies are not evenly distributed. So as a result, Dr. Dwayne Gish of the Creation Research Institute, he said, when we get into really talking about this, what are we actually saying about God? We are saying, first of all, that God is inefficient. I've got this quote here on page 70N. He says, evolution is the most wasteful, inefficient, cruel method that could be devised to create living things. Even evolutionists admit that almost all mutations are bad, causing cripples, sickness, disfigurements, and deaths. But God is all-powerful and wise. Why would he use such a wasteful, inefficient, cruel method to create man, taking 3 billion years to do it when he's able to create instantaneously? Why would God do that? You could say, well, God is God. He can do as he wishes. If he wants billions and billions of things to die, and he wants to do things very, very inefficiently, I mean, he's God. But it seems to be, does not seem to be consistent in my thinking with what we find the rest of Scripture. Theistic evolution is also unscientific. He says, quote, there's not one fact of science which proves that God used evolution to create anything. End quote. In fact, it's really generous to call evolution a theory, because for something to be a theory, it has to be testable. You have to make a hypothesis. I think this is true. Now let's test it. But you cannot do that with evolution. Evolution is, in reality, a belief system like creation that you cannot test. And we should admit that creation is also a faith system, because we weren't there when the world was created either. And so we have to acknowledge that. But that's at least putting them both on equal ground. Evolution and creation are both faith systems, because none of us were there. Now we have to look at... we have to look at what we see around us and make a reasoned guess, looking around as to whether what we see is evidence of design or of random processes. It can be illustrated pretty simply just by taking something as simple as a computer. You know, if I told you that this computer was a result of millions and millions of years of random processes, and there was no intelligence to put together this computer, well, some of you are PC users, you'd say, yeah, that's true, that's a Mac, you know? No, we all recognize that something as quite simple as this is actually quite simple compared to the entire universe. It would demonstrate design. In that sense, that's why Dr. Gish is saying theistic evolution is actually unscientific. The other part, when he talks about it being unscientific, is he's talking about the fossil record. And these are my own words summing up what he says here. If God guided evolution, he's not allowed a single intermediate form of life to survive as evidence. Surely he wouldn't allow all scientific facts to counter his creative process. All fossils represent fully formed creatures, just as one would expect from the Genesis account. So basically, evolution relies on a theory of transitional forms, which would actually have been easy prey. If the reptiles were waiting for their legs to turn into wings, they would have been very easy prey, with legs that are no good for walking and wings that are no good for flying. And do you think a creature like that would last very long in a world of other creatures eating up? I mean, I believe in the survival of the fittest. Maybe, you know, the animals that are the most fit are the ones that are actually going to survive. It goes against the whole idea of natural selection. Same thing for fish that's trying to get rid of their fins and wait for their fins to turn into legs. So that's what you end up with. You end up with a crocker bird. A crocker bird. That's what I call it. This is somebody who knows how to use Photoshop quite well, don't you think? Put a crocodile head on a bird. But that's what they're actually believing, in the sense they're not believing the crocker bird. I'm just making that up. I'm just saying that there is a the belief of evolutionists is that reptiles turned into birds. But all we find in the fossil record are actual animals that are fully formed. And we've been looking and we've found there's billions and billions of fossils around the world. It's a kind of a vain hope. Dwayne Gish wrote the book Dinosaurs by Design. I forgot to bring this one up. Maybe if you guys want to borrow this one, you can borrow this one as well. Did dinosaurs come before man? Yes. Because they were both created on the sixth day of creation and probably a few hours earlier. You think I'm kidding, right? What we've got in the evolutionary model is we've got what has been called the ascent of man. I call it the descent of man. Because we have been led to believe, and I grew up with all of this. My parents are evolutionists and were quite dismayed to see that their son had become a Christian. And I started believing Genesis 1 as a teenager. And the descent continues, you know. The idea is that we have come from ape-like creatures up to our present state. And some would say we're actually going back down that same way, you know. And there have been a lot of embarrassing things for the evolutionists when it comes to these various so-called ape men. Starting back with Piltdown Man, and I've got this in your notes, found in Piltdown, England in 1912. They built Piltdown Man from jaw and skull fragments. All right? Some of the fragments, they ended up putting it all together to say that our very rudimentary type of man in Piltdown, England was discovered here. And for the next 40 or so years until around 1950, over 500 books and pamphlets were written about him. All right? It was discovered, though, in 1950 that it actually was a chemically treated skull of a modern human to make it look old. And these are ape teeth that were filed down to look human. The Piltdown Man fooled the world's so-called experts for almost 40 years. And he went from being one of the biggest discoveries of the 20th century to being one of its greatest scientific embarrassments. Nebraska Man. 10 years later, 1922, in Nebraska, United States, was built from one tooth. Okay? They found one tooth, and the tooth did not match any known species of man or animals. But later on, additional bones were discovered, and it showed that this actually was actually a pig. So Nebraska Man is not actually a man at all. Piltdown Man is a man, but Nebraska Man's a pig. We should call him Nebraska Pig. Neanderthal is the one that's gotten the most press. Goes back the farthest, I guess, 1860. Hunched over, flatter skulls. In 1908, it was shown to be a Frenchman who had arthritis, and therefore he was far more hunched over. X-rays confirmed the Neanderthal actually to be humans with rickets caused by a lack of vitamin D. This is from the Neanderthal Valley in Germany. And hundreds of skeletons of such people were found. But I would say that they actually were... it was a whole group of people that were suffering from a lack of vitamin D, having rickets, which is we don't see so much nowadays anymore because we see the importance of vitamin D. What about Lucy? Australopithecus afarensis. She was named Lucy and believed to be an ape, a female version of the evolutionary chain. They found not quite an intact whole skeleton, so they used a knee joint from 60 meters lower in the strata. They found a knee joint there, so they took the 60 meters below, they brought that up and put it on Lucy. Because she needed, everybody needs knees, right? 60 meters lower in the strata and more than 3 kilometers away. These kind of things were not told to the public, but they came out later on. I find it very deceptive to say, for these people to say to creationists that we're tweaking all the data and trying to change all the data to make it support our preconceived notion that we get from Genesis 1, and yet the reality is often it's the other way around. So when a knee joint was needed to prove that Lucy walked upright, because actually Lucy was an older type of ape, they got it from far, far away to try to prove this theory. The others have been disproved as well. Ramapithecus was found to be an orangutan. Orsay Man was actually a donkey, 6-month-old donkey. Australopithecus was an ape. Java Man was a giant gibbon. Peking Man was an ape. Cro-Magnon Man was a person, a modern European. Now some evolutionists are even saying that apes evolved from humans.
apes evolved from humans.
Wow, that's
cool. So, has this, is this news to you? Probably for some of you, this is quite a big thing. And yet, in our textbooks, these diagrams that have been there for generations continue to be there, generation after generation, even though many of these things have really been disproven. In fact, no other viewpoints are allowed. Ben Stein brings that out in his movie, Expelled. He interviews academics and scientists who have been thrown out of their institutions, their scientific organizations, or their universities for even suggesting that our world has design. Quite an amazing, amazing thing. And what we find is that people are saying that the soft glob-like lump of spineless mesh has actually moved its way all the way up, and we're back to the same sort of thing. You know, we're a soft lump of spineless mesh. And so I see some big problems with theistic evolution from the scientific point, and I'm relying on the scientists here because I'm not a scientist, I'm a theologian. But I think the theological problems of theistic evolution are even more severe here. You find in Genesis 1 and 2 a straightforward account of creation with not even a hint of evolution. In fact, I would love to see someone put Genesis 1 into the eyes of 100 people and have them read it. 100 people from any and every walk of life, and then ask them at the end of it, how long does this little chapter here say that it took God to create the world? I guarantee you at least 99 of them are going to say 6 days. Now, many of them will say, I don't believe it, but that's what that says. The clarity is pretty much there. And that is, even though we've got a different reckoning of day there, and I won't get into all that right now. I think there's a huge theological problem with theistic evolution in terms of the fall and the origin of moral evil. Collins says, quote, that the story of Adam and Eve is, quote, a poetic and powerful allegory of God's plan for entrance of the spiritual nature, the soul, and the moral law into humanity, end quote. That's how he deals with Adam and Eve. It's an allegory. He has to conclude something similar to that because he's trying to combine both theism and evolution. And what that does is it just destroys what Romans 5 is saying about Christ being the last Adam, about Christ being the one who resolves the issues that were caused by the first Adam. In fact, we've got problems with the origin of man as well. Was man from ape-like creatures ascending like that, or was man created from the dust? Is man in the image of God? Was Eve truly the mother of all living, or were there pre-existent hominids, is the word that's being used now? Not quite humans, but they're like humans without a soul. They're a hominid. God infuses a soul into them, and then she becomes like the first Eve and first Adam, and he becomes the first Adam. How is it they all sinned in Adam if there was no Adam? And what about natural selection, death, and suffering? When we go into Genesis 3, we have monotheism, we have one God, all is good, man is without sin, there's no pain or evil, and I would say there's also no death, and they're ruling with God. And in a theistic evolution viewpoint, you don't have that at all. You've got millions and millions of years of death preceding Adam. And who is man? Is man really a creative act of God, or from lower life forms? We find in Genesis that we are the highest of created beings. I'm not willing to give that up. Not out of pride, but because if God's going to give us a high status, why should we lower ourselves? We are commissioned to rule with God, and no animal has ever been given such a privilege. In fact, man, like the animals, reproduces after his own kind. So if you're talking about what is scientific, what we know from science is that dolphins give birth to dolphins. Apes give birth to apes. Everything multiplies based on its own kind. You know, it multiplies to its own kind. That's what we find from science. We don't find one species shifting on over to another species. We're very different from animals, with a different to discern truth. Because God said, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In fact, you don't find... I've seen some of these movies of Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, and they're going... You know, they're grunting like this. And I refuse to show those in class. You know, I got a Cain and Abel movie that I'm not going to show you. Because these guys don't talk to one another. Well, their mother and their father talked to one another. Very first thing Adam said was, "Whoa, man!" That's how he named her, "Whoa, man," you know? Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. It's like he wasn't at a loss for words. He was communing with God. He was communing with Eve. And I presume that Adam and Eve taught Cain and Abel also how to speak, you know? Marriage, relationships, creative abilities, all these things are really, really destroyed. Basically, the image of God is destroyed. This image of God that gives us the right to rule creation and relate to God and gives us dignity. Dr. Collins even says that there's no evidence of intelligent design either. He argues against intelligent design, page 85 of his book. He particularly takes issue with William Paley's watch illustration from 1802. Maybe you've heard this one. It's been around for 200 years. Here's how it goes. A watch is complex. All right? A watch has an intelligent designer. All right? Life is complex. Therefore, life also has an intelligent designer. So we've had watches for hundreds of years, and no one would argue that this watch came about through natural processes. There was an intelligent designer. Well, he says, nah, the fact that two objects share one characteristic, that's complexity, doesn't imply that they share all characteristics. He says, electric current in my house consists of a flow of electrons. Okay? Electric current comes from the power company. Lightning consists of a flow of electrons, a lot more electrons, right? Therefore, lightning comes from the power company. So he's... Now, do you agree? Are these parallel?
No.
Are these parallel? How are they different? How are these syllogisms different? He's trying to argue from the simple to the greater. If the simple is complex, then the greater is complex. And he says that argument doesn't really go. Here's a better parallel, I think. Electric current in my house consists of a flow of electrons. Electric current comes from a power source, you know. Lightning consists of a flow of electrons. So, therefore, lightning comes from a power source. There's your true syllogism. That which is complex not through random processes. It's complex because someone far smarter than the object actually made the object. And that's actually what we find in our universe as a whole. I shared with you about Dr. George Wald saying that spontaneous generation is what he preferred to believe. So we have to make a choice. How did order come? By random processes, by an unintelligent source, or by design from an intelligent God? I put that before you so that you will recognize that we need to believe what God says, and that there really is truly no true marriage between theistic belief and evolutionary belief. And I'd invite you to go to Answers in Genesis if you want some more help in understanding this in a greater sense.